Welcome to Russian History Retold. Episode 299, an interview with Professor Simon Miles, author of Engaging the Evil Empire. Our guest today is Assistant Professor of Slavic and Eurasian Studies and History in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University, Simon Miles. His first book, Engaging the Evil Empire, Washington, Moscow, and the Beginning of the Cold War, explores the root causes of cooperation between two adversarial states, the United States and the Soviet Union, in order to situate the peaceful conclusion of the Cold War in a broader international context. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Miles.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
As my listeners know, my family had a very deep history in kind of an anti-communist thought process. And, you know, my first visit to East Germany was in 1970 when my father and I went to East Berlin to visit some relatives who were on the other side of the wall. We saw the difference between West Berlin, where my grandfather lived, and my other relatives in East Berlin. And we saw the kind of as my father would put it, it was trist, very sad, kind of depressing. And I noticed there were still bullet holes in the walls of East Berlin, but that no longer exists today. And what we saw also, they also know that my history professor, Dr. Paul Average, in 1976, told our class that the Soviet Union had less than 20 years left before they would dissolve. We thought he was crazy. You know, come on, this is the Soviet Union, the big two power, and that's unrealistic. And also, I came across a book a few years ago from my brother called The Coming Soviet Crash by Judy Shelton. And she laid out in 1989 how the Soviet Union would collapse because of economic issues. But you have a little bit of a different take on this. And in your book, you tracked key events in the U.S.-Soviet relationships between 1980 and 1985. And can you comment on why that five-year period was so crucial in defusing the Cold War?
Yeah, I was drawn to that period really because there was this puzzle for me when I thought about the history of the Cold War. And the basic puzzle was, how did we get from the collapse of U.S.-Soviet detente, right? Definitely sort of definitively dead in Afghanistan and when the Soviet Union invades in late 1979, but probably, you know, in its palliative care for the preceding few years as well during the Carter administration. How do we get from that low state of relations between Washington and Moscow to kind of this textbook case of adversaries putting aside their differences and cooperating that is the common perception of U.S.-Soviet relations at the end of the Cold War? And I say, you know, textbook case kind of with tongue in cheek, because literally in textbooks, in international relations textbooks, this is a common illustrative case study of Reagan and Gorbachev and then Bush and Gorbachev sort of cooperating, getting huge arms control deals done. U.S. government frequently, especially in the last years of the Soviet Union, providing much more support for Gorbachev than he could find at home. So that was the question, is how do we get from this story in the mid to late 1970s of the end of detente to this late 1980s story of Washington and Moscow, Reagan and Gorby, sort of walking practically arm in arm across Red Square. And so that was what really drew me to this first half of the 1980s period, because it seemed to me that something had to have happened during that time that explained this transformation. Something like that doesn't just come up sort of out of thin air. And that was striking because at the same time, the common story of the early 1980s is a pretty scary one. This is sort of the lowest point of U.S.-Soviet relations, the so-called kind of Second Cold War. And whether you blame that on, you know, the turbo hawk Ronald Reagan or you blame it on the sort of Kremlin gerontocracy, none of the indicators should point towards an improvement of relations. They should point towards the opposite. And yet an improvement of relations is what we got. So that, it seems to me that something has to have had to have happened during the first half of the 1980s, let's say, you know, Reagan's first term. Something had to have happened at a time when the conventional wisdom says that nothing really did. And that's why I sort of went looking in this area. And what I found in extensive work in not only the American and the Russian archives, but also sort of archives across Europe, including critically Eastern Europe, was that the key to understanding not just the scope of the change from, you know, enmity to buddies, but also the speed of the change was kind of in that beginning of the decade, the beginning of the 1980s. And it's a story of a shift in the perceived balance of power from one favoring the Soviet Union at the beginning of the 1980s to one favoring the United States by sort of midpoint of the decade, a shift from a kind of war of words coupled with back channel dialogue at the beginning of the decade to sort of overt dialogue and symmetry by the mid 1980s. So that's sort of this transformation predicated on how both states understood the global balance of power, which I argue in the book gets us to the largely peaceful end of the Cold War.
I remember that period of time where we had a lot of fear. You know, there was a lot of commentary by the media, world leaders about how things were going, and, you know, we're in a very dangerous time. And then we started seeing, you know, Gorbachev's glasnost and other policies changing dramatically. And we saw kind of like our hero in the Soviet Union. You know, it's after, you know, losing Brezhnev and then, you know, Andropov and then, you know, Chernenko. And it's like, who are we dealing with? You know, Reagan's famous lines about, I don't know who I'm dealing with because they keep on dying on me. And then we get this new guy coming in. And it's really fascinating to me when I look at the backdrop of Gorbachev that he wasn't even allowed to know what was going on behind the scenes until he became the head of the Communist Party after Chernenko died. And, you know, Andropov saying, no, you have no right to look at the books. You have no right to look at what's going on back there. And I think it was a kind of a shock when Gorbachev became the premier that, oh, gosh, we're in trouble. We have some real issues here. And he was trying to find a way out. And that kind of, we didn't know that at the time, because, of course, they would keep that hidden. But you also talk about U.S. President Ronald Reagan's kind of carrot and stick approach to the dialogue between Washington and Moscow. You care to discuss this one further?
Happily, you know, your characterization of the early 1980s is one that would resonate, I think, with many, many people who lived through the period, right? Of this atmosphere of acute tension. And that was a product of, one, some very, I think, intentional sort of ginning up of an atmosphere of fear by the Soviet leadership. Who found that very politically useful on the home front as further justification for, you know, as you talked about a little bit earlier, the lower standard of living. This is why so much of the economy needs to be devoted to heavy industry above all the military industrial complex, because we sort of live in this very dangerous world. And if we're not prepared, then, you know, we're going to get caught by surprise. And at this point, the early 1980s, we're four decades after the last time the Soviet Union was caught by surprise, Operation Barbarossa, Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany's invasion of the USSR in the summer of 1941. That sort of fear of surprise is, well, let's be honest, a hallmark of national security leaders, right? That's a pretty sensible outlook, generally speaking. Surprises in national security tend not to be good news. Much less confetti and balloons, much more a horrific crisis. But part of the story is also what I talk about in the book, and I trace its evolution, which is Ronald Reagan's sort of dual track grand strategy for how the United States is going to use all of its implements of national power in order to prosecute, to fight and win the Cold War. And I think we should make no mistake about it that Reagan saw the Cold War as something that could be won, as opposed to just a sort of phase of human history that you could only manage and sort of exist through, hopefully survive through. Reagan, from a very early stage, perceived the Cold War as something that the United States could win. He felt that his predecessors, who had embraced the policy of détente with the Soviet Union, and that includes his fellow Republicans, Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, both of whom he challenged in primaries, as well as, of course, Jimmy Carter, the Democrat who preceded him, he thought that they were adopting policies towards the Cold War, which basically resigned the United States to just living with the Cold War, as opposed to enabling the United States to actually win the Cold War. So Reagan's approach, as you said, was this carrot and stick, Mark. So on the one hand, the stick, I think, is probably the famous Reagan, right? This is the Reagan who built up the United States military, not only in terms of the acquisition of very sort of high-profile weapon systems like the MX missile, like the B-2 stealth bomber, but also really return to the fundamentals. So a lot of the key pieces of military equipment in the United States, like the M1 Abrams tank, the UH-60 Black Hawk utility helicopter, the AH-64 Apache, all of those are Reagan administration investments that are literally still, albeit in upgraded versions and models, the backbone of American military power. Reagan also gave the military a huge pay raise that had the consequence of increasing the quality of the force enormously just in a few years, such that now it was actually hard to get into the military in the 1980s, whereas in the 1970s, these were the years of, you know, 4 years in county lockup or 4 years in the Marine Corps, take your pick, you know, defendant. So peace through strength is what Reagan called all of this. He felt when he was elected in 1980 that the United States was on the back foot. And it's fair to say that that was pretty common point of view across the United States. We remember Reagan as kind of the happy warrior, morning in America sort of optimist. But 1980 United USA was not really a very optimistic place. This was the world that have of panic at the pump, right? Huge gas lines. This was a country in a deep economic recession. And then Americans looked at the Soviet Union and its allies in Eastern Europe, and they didn't have these problems. Now, the reason they didn't have these problems was because their economy was heavily reliant on natural resources, especially, you know, oil and gas, for survival, which at the time of an oil embargo and crisis was good news, but was, you know, really not a diverse economy. And the pain that the United States was feeling at the time was the pain of kind of the adjustment to globalization after the dollar was unpegged from the gold standard during the Nixon administration. And the Soviet Union and its allies were basically autarkies who didn't feel the pain of globalization and the adjustment thereto, but also they couldn't harness it like the United States did. So people are pretty pessimistic, and Reagan believes that the United States needs to build up not only its military, but also its kind of political clout. He goes on a rhetorical offensive. You're probably familiar with the lines, Mark, you know, communism will end on the ash heap of history. That's 1982 before the British Parliament. The Soviet Union is an evil empire. It's 1983 for the National Association of Evangelicals. But there's another side to Reagan. And that's kind of the side of Reagan that I'm really most proud of the book showcasing. And that's what Reagan himself called quiet diplomacy. The need to not just build up these capabilities, but also lock in diplomatic gains based on that strength. And Reagan understood that you couldn't start from scratch if you wanted to make major agreements on the scale of like the INF Treaty in 1987, which destroys an entire class of nuclear weapon on the European continent. Reagan understood that he would need to generate some sort of bona fides with the Soviet leadership, but that now was not the time to make a lot of noise about it. And so there are some interesting stories that I tell in the book, and your listeners can hopefully check out, about secret back channels in places like Berlin and also in Yugoslavia. There are small sort of incremental steps taken over issues like, for example, the so-called Siberian Seven, a group of Pentecostalists who had been living in the basement of the U.S. Embassy. Reagan successfully negotiated for their release and their right to emigrate to the United States, where they could practice their religion freely. So this is the other side of that early 1980s period. And it's the side that, you know, folks like you who were sort of really clued into the threat perception were not blissfully, but, you know, unaware of, right? That because it was very intentionally being kept quiet by the Reagan administration, because that perceived American balance of power was so low in both quarters, the Washington and Moscow, it didn't seem to American policymakers that the time was ripe to go public. That changes in 1984 and 1985, and of course goes full on in the later years of the decade.
Yeah, it's fascinating that remembering that period, and so many of my listeners do remember it, and some, of course, don't. You know, they were born afterwards, but it was a period of fear, a period of malaise within the United States, as you mentioned, with the gas shortages. That's one of the things that we see today. Russia right now would like to have the price of gas way up there in oil, because that fuels their economy. You know, under Gorbachev, it did too. But his changes were like trying to get people to stop drinking all that vodka, which turned out to be one of the major sources of revenue, the taxes.
For the state.
And he cut that off, and it even further exacerbated the problem in their economy. We also look at, you know, at the time, communism started getting to a little bit of a foothold in the United States because of the recession. And they also remember that during the depression of the 1930s, Soviet Union wasn't affected, really, because they were detached from the economics of the whole globe. And again, in the 1980s, the same thing happened. So people were starting to go, maybe they have a system that's better. And Reagan wanted to fight quite a bit against it. And his rhetoric was very strong. And I know my parents, who were so anti-communist, were so enamored of him and his policies. They only focused on the bad things that were going on there, and they did not focus on the positives. But lastly, you really move away from a Washington-focused discussion in your book. And I got to tell my listeners, this is a book that's very approachable. Some of the others we've talked about, you know, were a little bit more scholastic in nature. And, you know, this one, we really can see some emotion behind what was going on. Best, and it is available in paperback, I might add, as of March 15th. But most historians, you know, talk about this Washington focus, and they don't talk about the back channel communiques as you did, and the internal strategy debates in Moscow, as well as Prague, East Berlin, and what was going on in Warsaw, you know, with the Poles starting to, you know, rise up and neglect their power in Moscow and just say, no, we are independent now, and it started crumbling. You care to discuss that back channel? You know,
yeah, I'd love to. So when I started writing this book, I sort of had two kind of twin North Stars, if you will. And so one was, I think this is such a fascinating topic. I wanted to write a book that was approachable, that someone who was not sort of a historian, but who was interested in history could read. That was always a big part of my goal here was to write something that, you know, maybe wasn't necessarily going to be sold at like the airport, like easy, quick, fast page turners to get you through a flight, but something that anyone who cared to could get into. That was really important to me, and I'm grateful that you feel like I succeeded in that front. The other thing that I was really adamant about was not just writing a history of American foreign relations. One, you know, this is like Newton's law. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And so it seemed to me that if I was going to try to understand what happened during that first half of the 1980s with all the puzzles it presented, that I needed to ask that question in Moscow, not just in, you know, Simi Valley, where the Reagan Presidential Archives are, or, you know, the various other archives in the U.S. that I visited. And so I spent quite a bit of time working in the Russian archives in Moscow, which were actually quite open on a lot of the issues that I was interested in during the last years of Brezhnev and the Andropov, Chernenko, and Gorbachev years. But this is still very recent history. And so as I was kind of bumping up into walls in U.S. and Russian archives alike, I worked out that I could basically do a little bit of what I called researching through the back door. And this was especially really valuable in the archives of former Soviet allies in Eastern Europe that had now made the transition to democracy. Basically, a glut of laws passed from sort of right after German reunification all the way to 2016 in Ukraine, when a law along these lines were passed. You'll see also some Ukrainian sources in the book as well. Effectively declassified everything from the communist period, partly kind of as a sort of national reconciliation, partly because non-existent states can't have state secrets anymore. And that was a goldmine for me. So, for example, the Berlin Back Channel, which is a large chunk of one of the book's chapters, I came across not in the Russian archives, but actually in the East German Communist Party archives, because the East Germans, since, you know, they were basically the hosts, let's say, were getting copies of the memoranda of conversation, of the records of these meetings. I'm sure those documents exist somewhere in Russia. I have not been able to access them, but I got them in Berlin. And there's so much throughout the book where I'm really indebted to the Eastern European archivists who run these amazing repositories, where I was able to access really high-level secrets that are not accessible in Russia. And there's a parallel side to that, primarily in the UK, where the American declassification system, which is painfully slow, has been overtaken by the British declassification system, also the French declassification system. So this kind of backdoor approach, I think, opened up a whole new world of information to me on what was going on in the early 1980s. And above all, it really was a powerful reminder that, like, states, even superpowers, don't operate and exist with zero constraints. You know, there's a little story in the book where the Reagan administration wants to impose sanctions on the Soviet Union about a natural gas pipeline from Siberia that's going to bring gas to European markets. This is at the same time of the crisis in Poland in the early 1980s that you mentioned earlier, Mark. Reagan's got this whole package of sanctions. We're going to shut this thing down. Why on earth would we let, you know, the Soviet Union generate hard currency at a time when they are oppressing the Poles and generally misbehaving? Actually, there are some reasons why. And the loudest advocate is probably Reagan's closest ideological and political partner in the wider world. It's Margaret Thatcher, mm-hmm. who observes that, well, she's no fan of the Soviet Union. The United Kingdom has some economic troubles, just like we were talking about in the United States. And major British firms would very much like the enormous quantity of business that they're going to get, because Soviet engineering capabilities were not yet kind of sufficiently sophisticated for some of the work in the permafrost and things like that, that you know, this is really technical stuff. And so British firms that had experience, for example, with North Sea oil and things like that, get these contracts. And so Reagan's effort kind of dies. And it's because of Margaret Thatcher. It's not because of anything the Soviets or the Warsaw Pact do.
Yeah, how surprising that is. You know, Maggie she was the Ronald Reagan of UK, the Iron Lady, as they called her.
And so, right, but emphasis on of the UK. And so she had her own national interests to look out for.
And so did, you know, the Germans. They wanted to get some of that, you know, oil in and the rest of the Western European countries. And there was a time when the oil prices, not compared to today, but at that point where they were very high, and if they were able to access that, that would alleviate a lot of their inflationary problems, their recessionary problems. So economics usually does trump politics quite often, as we see in today's world. And we see it right now with the way our governments are now challenging Russia and not allowing them to get as much financial benefits from dealing with the West because of their invasion of Crimea and then of Ukraine and continuing on. And now the new evil empire, you know, the Russians, we kind of abandoned after the collapse in 1991. I had a couple of episodes where I talk about why is this adversarial issue going on with Russia? Because in 1991, we just said, okay, you deal with it. You become democratic. You become capitalists, and we abandoned them. We didn't give them any aid. We gave aid to like the Czech Republic and Poland and all the other Eastern Bloc countries, but we failed to do anything for the Russians. And they were actually wanting to have a good relationship with us. But then that kind of collapsed because they felt abandoned. And I think there was that rapprochement that Reagan did, you know, in the back channels, which he put out very, you know, eloquently in the book. And I also want to tell my listeners that the book is available. I'll have a link to it in the notes. You can find it at, you know, an Apple and wherever you get your podcast, Spotify or whatever, so they can link to the book, because I found it to be an incredibly great read. I was pretty enamored of it. I just had a little vacation where I was able to read a little bit more about it. And it was just fascinating to see the things that I didn't know about that period of time. And I've, you know, researched it quite extensively, my library, and it's very different from what I saw many of the other historians, like Zuboff, who, you know, talks about the collapse of the Soviet Union and how he really, you know, looked at this adversarial thing and the Star Wars with what Reagan promoted with his military that actually wasn't as big as we think it was. And, you know, there's so much else that went on. I really appreciate your coming on to the podcast and really tell my listeners, you've got to get this book. This is really fascinating. If you want to know more about that period of time and what happened with, you know, the U.S.-Soviet relationship, the end of the Cold War, and then eventually the collapse of the Soviet Union. So thank you, Professor Miles, for being on the show. And
thanks for having me, Mark. It was a pleasure talking about the book with you. And hopefully your listeners are equally enthusiastic if they pick up a copy.
Yeah, and hopefully can come on when you have your next book out, because I saw that you're working on another one. I don't know if that's still the case when I looked at your bio on Duke University site.
That's right. You know, I was waxing poetic about the Eastern European archives, so I'm actually working on a project that is a history of the Warsaw Pact, sort of building on the work that I was able to do then and just exploiting the enormous amount of material that's available to us historians. So I'll look forward to talking with you about that in a few years.
Then it'll be a few years. Yeah, hopefully we continue. And, you know, my listeners know this is coming upon the 14th year of the podcast. So hopefully we can do another 14 if I'm still around at that time. And thank you again.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I surely did. Join me next time for episode 300, where the topic I've chosen is known as the Great Game, the competition between the Russian and British empires for control and influence in Central Asia during the 19th century.
So until then, до свидания и спасибо за внимание.